Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, March 18, 2014. As the standoff continues between the Central Intelligence Agency and its purported overseers, the Senate Intelligence Committee, information is leaking out about what is contained in that fought-over 6,000-page report on the CIA's involvement in torture, detention, what we called rendition, kidnapping, and related policies. And credit goes to the intrepid Jason Leopold, a longtime friend and contributor to this program, and publishing at Al Jazeera America today. Jason has some really important findings about what is in that contested report. At least one high-value detainee, as they call the suspects, was subjected to torture techniques that went beyond those that had been authorized. And some of the torture started before anything was authorized. I was about to say legally, but what they did was illegal. And at issue right now, according to some reports, the reason the White House is sitting on over 9,400 pages of CIA documents is that at least one of them, apparently, is the authorization from George W. Bush to his then CIA director, George Tenet, to break the law. Well, they tried to rewrite the law so it would appear it wasn't being broken, but it was the authority to torture. And Leopold weighs in here, and with his sources and his in-depth past coverage of Abu Zubaydah, we learn that the torture techniques that were used on Abu Zubaydah happened even before some had been sanctioned as permissible by the Bush administration. And there is an issue about the notes of FBI agent Ali Soufan. This gets really interesting and very important. Soufan was one of the FBI agents who refused to participate in torture. But he was present when others performed torture techniques. And here's a quote from Ali Soufan in his book called The Black Banners. In early 2008, in a SCIF, a Sensitive Compartmented Information Facility, that's a place where you can conduct classified conversations, I gave a classified briefing on Abu Zubaydah to staffers of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. The staffers present were shocked. What I told them contradicted everything they had been told by Bush administration and CIA officials. When the discussion turned to whether I could prove everything I was saying, I told them, remember, an FBI agent always keeps his notes. And then those notes apparently disappeared. It's unclear whether those are part of the documents held by the White House. Those are part of the documents that were first made available to the Senate intelligence staff and then retrieved, taken back by CIA handlers. And this relates as well to the Panetta Review. And the CIA argues that the Panetta Review never should have been released to the Intelligence Committee because it wasn't a formal review. It was informal, and therefore it's protected by the standards of executive privilege. But the White House has yet to assert executive privilege related to any CIA torture documents. That is a necessary step. So you can't claim that these are privileged when the privilege has not been properly claimed. So two of the Senate staffers have told Jason Leopold that the Panetta documents question the Bush administration claims about the efficacy of Abu Zubaydah's torture. Did it work? And the staffers noted that some of the techniques to which he was subjected had not yet been authorized. Now, there's another important disclosure here in Jason Leopold's article. I'll link to it, and you can read it for yourself in the show file at peterbcollins.com. And that is that he says that Dianne Feinstein and her Republican counterpart, Kit Bond of Missouri, assured Leon Panetta when he was running the CIA that their investigation was to draw lessons for future policy decisions, not to punish those who followed guidance from the Department of Justice. Now, this, to me, suggests that Feinstein and Bond agreed to obstruct justice. That before their investigation had been conducted, they had a foregone conclusion that no one would be prosecuted. No one would be held accountable. Now, the language here reads not to punish those who followed guidance from the Department of Justice. That would be the memos from Jay Bybee and John Yoo that redefined torture. It said that these torture techniques called enhanced interrogation techniques were permissible. Well, it appears that Abu Zubaydah was subjected to techniques that were not even approved by the lax standards of Jay Bybee and John Yoo. Would that produce an investigation and prosecution? Well, knowing Feinstein and her attitudes, I doubt if that is her intention. But would she actively obstruct the prosecution, even of someone who is shown to have gone beyond the permissible standards issued by the Department of Justice under Bush? At what point do we stop moving the line that says a line was crossed and a crime was committed? This kind of rationalization, these situational ethics, these efforts to legalize what was clearly wrongdoing are un-American, they're irrational. I mean, they don't even fit objective standards of, you know, intellectual definitions of what is torture and what violates the law. And it seems like they just want to keep moving the goalposts to make sure the CIA never crosses them and can never be accused of wrongdoing. And this is really sordid. And, you know, we claim to be a nation of laws and this beacon of liberty where justice rules. And we don't live up to it in ways that are obvious to everyone but ourselves. In New York, at the trial of Osama bin Laden's son-in-law, Abu Ghaith, the judge has ruled that testimony, either written or verbal, from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed will not be permitted at this trial. You may know that over the weekend, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed submitted a 14-page document responding to questions put to him by lawyers. And he basically says that Abu Ghaith wasn't involved in any of the schemes of al-Qaeda. He was a mouthpiece. He was related to Osama bin Laden. But in particular, Mohammed said that he had no military role in al-Qaeda. He had no knowledge of pending al-Qaeda attacks. And so this is an effort by the defense to use a Guantanamo prisoner to say that this Abu Ghaith guy was not a central player in al-Qaeda. It seems to be pretty important testimony to me. But Judge Kaplan has said, nope. And he told a lawyer to sit down and pretty much shut up. While we're talking about legal matters, the lawyers for General Jeffrey Sinclair, who plea bargained his way out of the court-martial over his alleged sexual assault on his acknowledged mistress of 3 years, his lawyers are seeking a lenient sentence by downplaying the seriousness of the charges that he's pled guilty to and calling witnesses to discuss the character of this man. Yesterday, the sentencing process began. Prosecutors called the accuser, a 34-year-old captain, and her mother to discuss damage caused to her personal and professional life by her interactions with General Sinclair. And the captain took the stand, said she cannot trust anyone, fears her superiors are always going to take advantage of her. She said as their relationship soured, she fell into despair so deep that she threatened to kill herself so the general would listen to her. So she was clearly, you know, harmed by this relationship. And it's clear that she entered into it as a free adult, but it became coercive. He wouldn't allow her to be transferred. And it appears she became increasingly desperate. And maybe we can speculate as to that's the reason why they didn't believe her testimony would stand up to careful scrutiny. I still say that if she wanted a trial and she wanted to testify, she should have been permitted to present her evidence against the general. And now that won't be happening. And it underscores the need for true reform of the military justice system, particularly when it comes to sex crimes. Real people across America support this podcast with their subscriptions, like Faith Peoples, Gunnar Gunderson, Carl Hesterberg, and John Dickerson, who voluntarily doubles his monthly commitment. You can do it too. Just go to peterbcollins.com. Under my picture on the homepage, follow the link that says sign up. $5 a month is our minimum monthly subscription. You can double that or go to $20 if your budget permits it, and I would appreciate it if you can. Otherwise, the best deal is our $50 annual subscription, and new annual subscribers in the U.S. of A. get a complimentary copy, a bonus gift, John Dist's rockin' CD called Red Flag, and a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans supplied by our friend Russ Archibald on the Big Island of Hawaii. The other way you can support us without a subscription is to take our offer for a free one-month trial at audible.com. You sign up over there, you get a free audiobook download right at the get-go, and then after 30 days, you can cancel, not owe Audible a penny. But just for trying it out and my referring you, Audible will pay me $15. It's an easy way for you to make a few clicks and kick in $15 here. I would very much appreciate it if you can help out. More on the national surveillance state. Bart Gellman in the Washington Post today, based on documents from Ed Snowden, exposes the program called Mystic. And this is further confirmation of the whistleblowers that you have heard presented here. Russell Tice, Bill Binney, Tom Drake. And that is that NSA has the ability now to record millions of phone calls every day. And the NSA has built a system capable of recording 100% of a foreign country's telephone calls. The program is called Mystic. It started back in 2009. And it has a tool as part of the program called RETRO. Stands for Retrospective Retrieval. And it says that they record every single conversation nationwide in this unnamed country and hold them for 30 days in a buffer. And on day 30, they record over with the new day one. You follow that? Well, that's what they tell us. But they also, in the 30-day period, monitor some of those calls, select them out, and archive them. So this call buffer opens a door into the past. And while the Post doesn't make this connection, I will. The metadata, the phone numbers that were called, the length of the conversation, that is the catalog, the index, in order to find critical phone calls. We know the metadata is much more powerful than it appears on first glance. In connecting dots, connecting people, and also just observing what their interests are by how they use their telephone. And when you couple the collection of metadata on millions of innocent people, the recording of phone calls on entire nations on a daily basis, then the power to retrieve calls certainly would go well beyond 30 days. And so we don't know the exact scope of this. The Washington Post is withholding details that could be used to identify the country where it's being employed now or other countries where its use has been proposed. But it shows that this capability exists. Obama told us last May, don't worry, the NSA is not listening to your phone calls. Well, they're listening to some people's phone calls. Vladimir Putin gave a 47-minute address to the Russian parliament today in St. George's Hall in the Grand Kremlin Palace. And he basically accepted the applause of the assembled Russian electeds to close the chapter on the acquisition of Crimea. Now, he declared that it's an independent nation, and the treaty has been signed that will make the peninsula a part of Russia. So they're moving forward very quickly on this. And the speech, which I've just read accounts of, includes a lot of the historical background. A lot of it is resentment and long simmering anger that is felt by the Russian people going back decades, if not centuries. And so this is seen, or at least it's rationalized by Putin, as a just result. Assailing the West for what he has said were its broken promises. He said, quote, they cheated us again and again, made decisions behind our back, presenting us with completed facts. That's the way it was with the expansion of NATO in the East, with the deployment of military infrastructure at our borders. They always told us the same thing. Well, this doesn't involve you. So I offer this because I think it's important to understand the perspective of Putin and the Russians. And of course, America's hands aren't clean. 65 different groups were given $5 billion in Ukraine that led to the overthrow of the Yanukovych government. And we act as if we're the good guys here and Putin's just this aggressor. But you have to look at the backdrop here that the U.S. has been trying to basically encircle Russia by letting other countries or former Soviet republics join NATO, or at least come under the NATO umbrella. And it is that tilt toward Europe, not just for economic and cultural ties, but with military connections, that produces the threat that Russia responds to in its grab of Crimea. At the White House yesterday, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, also known as Abu Mazen, had what was described as a difficult meeting with President Obama. And the Palestinians brought a map of the West Bank, showing that 10,589 housing settlement units have been built since the Palestinians resumed peace talks with the Israelis 8 months ago. And this exposes that Israel is not sincere in its participation. It keeps moving the proverbial goalposts. And while the Palestinians have begrudgingly recognized Israel as a state, Israel now wants to be recognized as a Jewish state. That does not sell to the Palestinian people. And Israel knows that. They want to put the Palestinians over a barrel so they can make it seem like the Palestinians are the ones unwilling to make peace. But it's very clear to me that Israel will use every possible tactic to avoid meaningful negotiations. They want to squeeze the Palestinians out by continuing to build settlements as they gum the peace issue to death and run out the clock. Chris Hedges has a great piece published today at Truthdig. It's linked to in the show file for this podcast. It's entitled Israel's War on American Universities. And he reports that on March 7 at Northeastern University in Boston, a group called Students for Justice in Palestine was banned by the university, along with a threat of disciplinary measures against some of its members. What did they do? SJP posted on campus replicas of eviction notices that are routinely put up on Palestinian homes set for Israeli demolition. The university said that if the SJP group petitions for reinstatement, that no members of the current executive board may serve on the new organization. and that representatives from the organization must attend university-sanctioned trainings. Well, this is not the first case. In 2011, Hedges notes that 10 students at UC Irvine in California disrupted a speech by the Israeli ambassador Michael Oren, and they have been put on probation and sentenced to perform community service. Also, in Florida, at Florida Atlantic University, they stripped student leadership positions, or students of leadership positions, after they walked out of a talk by an Israeli army officer. At Columbia University, Students for Justice in Palestine was abruptly placed on suspension in the spring of 2011 and barred from reserving rooms and hosting events on campus. Now, these are clear violations of the First Amendment and of academic freedom. And it shows the heavy-handed response that Israel has. They are spooked by the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. And they're using their influence with the collaboration of willing academic leaders to suppress the expression of students on their campuses when it conflicts with the Israeli party line. And in his article, Hedges also talks about Max Blumenthal, who made quite an impression on me. I recommend the interview that we conducted with him last December. And by the way, I have one more copy of his powerful book, Goliath, in my bonus book box. And if you become a new subscriber and email me and mention that you'd like the Max Blumenthal book, I'll give it to the first person who makes that request. So Blumenthal talks about the efforts to shut him up because his book exposes the clear racism and the radical extremism that is rampant in Israel today. He says, on numerous occasions, Israel lobby groups and pro-Israel activists have attempted to pressure organizations into canceling my events before they took place. I've been slandered by teenage pro-Israel students, prominent magazine columnists, and even Alan Dershowitz as an anti-Semite. My family has been attacked in right-wing media simply for hosting a book party for me. The absurd lengths pro-Israel activists have gone to stop my journalism and analysis from reaching a wide audience perfectly illustrate their intellectual exhaustion and moral poverty. All they have left is loads of money to buy off politicians and the unlimited will to defend only nuclearized apartheid, to defend the only nuclearized apartheid state in the Middle East. Well said, Max. Well, guess what? The FBI has just revealed the case of another American who can be described as a domestic terrorist. They say he wanted to enlist in Al-Qaeda and go fight in the Syrian conflict. He is a 20-year-old from Acampo, which is near the town of Modesto, I believe. It's in the San Joaquin Valley, the Central Valley of California. His name is Nicholas Toussaint. And guess what? He had a paid FBI informant. And the boss of the FBI informant entered the picture shortly before he was arrested at the Canadian border early Monday. Toussaint traveled to that border, we're told, with the intent to continue on to Syria to join the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, the terrorist group more widely known as Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That's according to an FBI special agent. Now get this, to help pay for his trip to Syria, he sold his laptop computer through a paid FBI informant who delivered it to the agency. We've seen this time and again, where when someone doesn't have the means to activate a plan that was often hatched with the help of the paid FBI provocateur informant, the FBI says, we'll buy your computer. In one case, they bought some speakers and an audio system from a kid and traded them for weapons that didn't work. Now, I don't know what the intentions of Nicholas Toussaint were, but when the FBI entered the picture last summer, He was assigned this paid informant. And now, like 500 or more others, he's been busted by the FBI. Will he go to trial? Will we ever hear the evidence against him? Or, like so many others, will he be pressured into plea bargaining by heavy-handed tactics from our so-called Justice Department? I'd like to wrap up on a positive note today. California is enduring a drought. I talked to a friend in Brazil today where it was raining in Sao Paulo, but they have been experiencing very low rainfall levels. And desalinization, let me get the word right, desalination. A lot of people say desalinization like I just did, but the correct term is desalination. That's where you use a process to remove salt and other chemicals from water to make it usable for irrigation or even usable for drinking. And there is a new system being tested in California's Central Valley near Fresno. And it is showing a lot of potential. It's called Water FX. And this pilot program was funded with money from the state of California. And it's far cheaper. This one cost about $1 million to build. When conventional reverse osmosis desalination plants can cost as much as $1 billion, like the one being built near San Diego. And the way it works is that they take the tainted water. The solar plant captures this water, sucks in used irrigation water from underground, and sends that tainted water through a series of pipes and tanks that heat it. The heat comes from the plant's huge parabolic-shaped solar reflector, which focuses the sun on a long tube containing mineral oil. That heated tube creates steam, condenses the brackish water into usable liquid, separating out the minerals. The water is then available for irrigation. So, I don't know if this can be applied to seawater. I'm not enough of a scientist or a chemist to make that judgment. We may not have enough data, even for those who are qualified to do so, to reach any conclusions. But this is a low cost and requires no carbon-based energy, which is one of the pitfalls of the reverse osmosis system when it's applied to desalinating seawater. So I'm very encouraged by this. I think it's very interesting, and it just shows that we need to keep investing in research and development. That's something that we've cut back on in recent years because of our economic problems. And my final note today is for subscribers at peterbcollins.com. I'm releasing an interview with Susan Ohanian. She is a former teacher who's written many books about the future of education in this country. She is sharply critical of Common Core. And in a recent interview with a professor from Harvard and one from UC Irvine, we talked about Common Core. And one of our listeners, Dick Attlee from the University of Maryland, was very disappointed by that interview. He referred me to Susan Ohanian, and I'd like you to listen to this excerpt from our in-depth interview. As she talks about how our education system is being tasked to solve greater problems that our country faces that are at the core of the poor performance in our schools. Here's that excerpt with Susan Ohanian.
Well, ostensibly it was to reduce the great gap between poor and affluent students, but my complaint is that you can't do that through the schools. If you want to raise standards, the first thing you have to do is have a living wage. All of the politicos seem to think that the schools can undo the wrongs of our economic system. And until we have students in our classrooms whose parents earn a living wage, we are always going to have a great gap in achievement.
Wow. I mean, those kinds of cultural factors rarely enter in to this heated debate we have about education, where often the bottom line is just cheap shots at teachers.
That's right. And they're trying to hide the terrible economic problems our country has right now.
Mm-hmm.
They hide it by blaming teachers. That's convenient.
Yeah.
Easy thing to do. And then say, you know, then they say, oh, well, poverty is just an excuse. It's not just an excuse, it's a reality. We have 1.6 million homeless children in this country. Homeless.
Mm-hmm.
And they're telling us to raise our academic standards. In many of our urban schools, the poverty rate is above 90%. In over half of our states, the poverty rate in public schools is over 50%. Let's talk about that if we want to talk about standards.
Mm-hmm. You can hear the full interview with Susan Ohanian. It's available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com. Thanks for joining me for my news and comment. This podcast is free, and you are free to distribute it absolutely everywhere.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.